There can be miracles when you believe. But that's not what we're doing today. Today on Einhart This, an ode to doubt. Here's a look at the virtues of not knowing, of questioning what you do know, and of second-guessing, and how that might make us better. You're listening to Einhart This. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. One Sunday, my 9-year-old daughter, Ren, was waiting for her friend to come over for an afternoon playdate. Now, when I say she was waiting for this friend, I don't mean that she was, like, lounging around, reading, or jumping on the trampoline, or sorting through her Pokemon cards. No, in her typical hardcore style, she went out and literally paced back and forth in the front yard, and back and forth, and back and forth, with occasional breaks to come in and check the clock in the living room. Yeah, she took waiting seriously. And when I got a call from the friend's parents at 1:40, 20 minutes before ETA, I knew we were in trouble. Ren's prospective playdate was having a tricky time completing his chores, the parents said. There's a chance we won't make it, but you know, we might if we could pull it together. We'll see how things go. Can't make any guarantees. Maybe we'll be there. I don't know. We'll text you. And then Ren ran in and checked the clock. 17 minutes. And jogged back outside to pace in the front lawn. Ugh. Here goes. Of course, when I broke the news, Ren melted into a wailing puddle. She screamed for me to go away! And she spent the next 10 minutes sobbing, I want my mama! And when she finally tamed the wild horses of her disappointment enough to come to the living room and sit on the couch and let me rub her back, she asked between sniffles, is he coming or not? I don't know, kiddo. I don't think his family knows either. I don't like not knowing. It doesn't feel good. What if we start a project, I suggested. Maybe do some Legos. But she couldn't even think of it. She was stuck in between. If she knew that her friend wasn't coming, she could have gotten sad, gotten over it, and then gone on with her day. But instead, she spent the rest of the afternoon pacing, watching the clock, and waiting to see what happened. In 1991, Pema Chodron, an American Buddhist nun, published a book called The Wisdom of No Escape. No escape, that is, from uncertainty. There is no answer key to life. All of us will regularly and inevitably get stuck in between with no clue about whether the playdate will happen. As Neil deGrasse Tyson likes to say, the universe has no responsibility to make sense to us. We're just going to have to get used to it. There are all kinds of uncertainties. Like Ren, we can be stuck with uncertain outcomes. For example, we can't know whether we'll get into the college of our dreams. Alternatively, we can be caught in ambiguities, like when the object of your crush might be flirting with you or might just be a nice and outgoing person. Or we could be torn by indecision, like when you have two job offers at the same time, each with their own pros and cons, and one of them needs a decision by next Tuesday. I positively drowned in indecision in my 20s. I knew I had to choose some direction in life, some career or dream or ambition or life's work, but every choice required that I kill off some other dream. So like Ren, I found myself pacing back and forth, entertaining one fantasy of the future after another without ever really choosing, and unintentionally choosing the status quo by default. Perhaps the hardest uncertainty, though, is doubt. The kind of uncertainty that happens when something upends what we assumed to be true. It can be really hard to change your mind. When the world doesn't match up with our beliefs, it can feel a lot like our playdate has failed to materialize. It's easy to get angry, to continually ask why, to call for mama, and to keep on pacing and looking at the clock, waiting for the world to conform to our expectations instead of just changing them. The more important the belief, the harder this struggle gets, and not just for the obvious reasons. We can probably all think of examples of people who found it hard to accept that they were wrong, and even harder to admit it. But being stuck in a belief isn't just about stubbornness. It's not just about accepting or admitting. It's also about being able to see that you are wrong at all. Human brains, for whatever reason, are riddled with biases. We really don't see or don't trust the evidence that contradicts what we want. We reflexively justify what we've done. As Ren said, not knowing doesn't feel good. And that seems especially true of not knowing whether our beliefs and assumptions about the world hold water. Something there is in us that does not love the messy and unsure and that wants it down and ironed out and squared away. Who hasn't just wished that the damn biopsy results would come back already, or that the house sale would go through, or that they would just please post the final exam grades? Even if the results are scary and disappointing, we'd rather have them just so we can get on with things. Who hasn't longed for someone to just tell us what to do or what is right? I think about uncertainty a lot. In my recent episode on the apocalypse, I explored how we find joy in an uncertain world. But in today's episode, I'd like to just take some time to appreciate doubt itself and the people who do it well. I deeply admire people like Pema Chodron, who seem to have found ways to become comfortable with uncertainty. I emulate people who change their minds even when it's hard. Doubt may not be much fun, but we are better for it. So, this is a love song, an ode to questioning our beliefs, to people who are willing to change them, and to those among us who are able to pivot and get on with their days, even when the playdate we've expected all morning doesn't materialize. You're listening to I Heart This. Before I dive into doubt, I think it makes sense to talk about belief. Despite everything that I've just said about the importance of changing one's mind, I'm not against belief. That'd be crazy. I mean, without belief, we'd have no way to navigate the world. We'd never know what to do. Picking out a loaf of bread at the supermarket would be an inscrutable enigma. Lots of other animals, like spiders, for example, probably don't need to rely on beliefs at all. They arrive in the world with blueprints of intricate webs and the procedures for making them already mapped out inside their brains. Instinct makes them automatically good at the things they need to be good at. But animals with more complex brains, like humans, we have instincts too, but we also have something more. If we want to do something complicated like weaving, we can learn how. In fact, learning has been such a successful strategy for humans that we have to believe, we have to learn, just to get by. It's easy to imagine a belief as like some individual logical statement, like, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, or the sky is blue, or you should never get involved in a land war in Asia. But in reality, beliefs hardly ever stand alone. Rather, they're almost always connected to other beliefs in complicated ways. They can, for example, form procedures for how to do something, or arguments for why something is right. But the most common and most powerful structure is story. As cognitive scientist Daniel Willingham says, story has a privileged place in our minds. Our capacity to take the extravagantly complicated world and make sense of it by telling a story is one of the keys to humanity's extraordinary success. Stories are particularly flexible. The ingredients are simple. They have characters who are people we can identify with, who want things and do things and have things happen to them. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end. In stories, events are linked by cause and effect, and those linkages have personal meaning for us. Jesus died for your sins. Our forefathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in liberty. Brad left Jennifer for Angelina. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that our science, our politics, our religions are just interconnected webs of stories. And stories work. We invest in them because good ones really do predict how things will turn out and guide us to effective choices. With Isaac Newton's story about gravity, you can even guide your rocket to the moon, land it there, and return to tell the tale. Stories also work in ways that are less tangible, but no less real. They inspire, convince, they provide solace. When I was young, the Christian story of the Catholic Church gave me profound comfort and purpose and meaning. By all measures, I had a comfortable, stable childhood sheltered from the uncertainties of the world. But I still found consolation in going to church. As a Catholic, I always knew who was in charge. I knew where I stood. I knew what was right and wrong. Heck, I even knew the exact number of choirs of angels. 9. By the way, sure, we had our trademark brand of guilt that was passed out with the communion wafers, but I loved having someone to pray to who was always going to listen and who always had my best interests at heart. God was love, and love was something worth living for. I love having something to believe in. I love having what science historian Michael Shermer calls a believing brain. I love the power that stories have to transport me and inspire me and give me a vision of my best self. If the alternative is to just run on genetic programming, I'll choose the stories. I'll choose belief every time. But just as instinct makes fish vulnerable to the fisherman who carries a torch to the lake at night, my stories make me vulnerable too. This happens in part because beliefs don't just describe the world. They change how we perceive it. In The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Joseph Campbell retells the story of a young girl playing Hansel and Gretel with a trio of matches, one for Hansel, one for Gretel, and one for the Wicked Witch. The girl is playing along for a while when she suddenly screams and her father runs in asking her, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" Probably thinking she's like set the couch on fire, but it isn't the couch. The girl shouts, "Daddy, Daddy, take the witch away. I can't touch the witch." Anyone who has lived with a toddler knows that this is not far-fetched, but this isn't just a thing that happens to toddlers. All of us confound the match and the witch sometimes. Colonialists really did see the inhabitants of colonized lands as subhuman. Kings and popes really do radiate power in the eyes of their subjects, even though they're just regular people in funny hats. Hurricanes really do become the wrath of an angry god or the purposeless consequence of a butterfly flapping its wings, depending on your story. When you expect a bad day, everything really does go wrong. And when you are in love, the world really couldn't be brighter. I can't think of a better story to illustrate this point than that of Ignaz Semmelweis. In 1846, this young Hungarian doctor showed up for a new job in a maternity ward of Vienna General Hospital. Vienna General was a teaching hospital. Its campus was a nearly 200-year-old sprawling center of both treatment and research, and its maternity ward had a problem. Postpartum women and their newborn babies were dying in agony from a condition popularly known as childbed fever, and nobody knew why. Childbed fever was not uncommon. It affected women all over the world, but at the ward in Vienna General, childbed fever was epidemic. Women who knew its reputation would beg on their knees not to be admitted. Some gave birth in the streets, claiming to be on their way so that they would still be eligible for benefits without having to step foot in the ward. In 1846, about 1 in 10 mothers who went through that clinic died. As part of a new scientific movement in medicine, Semmelweis began looking for something that might shed some light on the childbed fever epidemic. And he didn't have to go far. On the hospital's campus was another maternity ward. This one wasn't staffed by doctors, but by midwives. Women who hadn't received formal medical training, but who helped deliver babies in the same way that midwives had for millennia. The midwifery ward was in the same climate, in the same community, with the same clientele. It'd be the perfect comparison. Being a numbers guy, Semmelweis started gathering data from both clinics, and a staggering pattern emerged. Mothers in the medical clinic, the one staffed by the doctors, died at nearly 5 times the rate as the ones in the midwifery clinic. 5 times! What the heck? What was different? If he could find out, and if it was something he could replicate, he could save dozens of lives. Husbands wouldn't watch their wives die. Children wouldn't lose their mothers. Semmelweis meticulously documented every variable he could, and then he set out to systematically investigate each one. It wasn't the climate, it wasn't the clientele, it wasn't crowding. If anything, the midwives' ward was more crowded. The midwives' patients gave birth in different positions, so he tried adjusting the birthing positions in his own ward, but that had no effect. He even tweaked the habits of the visiting priest who came to minister last rites to the dead and dying. After months of investigation, nothing had worked. Frustrated and haunted by the deaths of the women and babies under his care, Semmelweis took a leave. He went on vacation to Venice, hoping to find some respite in the city's timeless art and maybe a fresh perspective on the problem. But upon his return, he was met with tragic news. His friend and colleague, the pathologist Jakub Kolechka, had died. A student had accidentally cut Jakob's finger with a scalpel during an autopsy. Over the next few days, Jakob contracted a fever and died in great pain. An autopsy of Jakob's body revealed that he died from widespread inflammation that had affected his lymphatic system, his veins, the pleura of his lungs, the pericardium around his heart, the lining of his abdominal cavity, and the meninges. That's the covering of the brain and spinal cord. And it's a condition that most people know today as meningitis. Semmelweis was distraught, but even in his grief, he recognized a pattern in Jakob's symptoms. They were almost exactly the same as childbed fever. Jakob didn't even work in a maternity ward. And once Semmelweis saw this, he realized that he'd missed a key difference between the doctor's maternity ward and the midwives. Doctors performed autopsies, and in a teaching hospital, they performed them with their students all the time. A doctor delivering a baby often had had his hands in a cadaver just hours or even minutes before. Could it be something about the cadavers that caused the disease? What if tiny little bits, so small that they'd be invisible, remained on the doctor's hands and instruments only to be transferred to the unfortunate mothers while they were examining them during birth? Maybe these little bits were what caused the fever. It took Semmelweis 2 months to work out a solution. He instituted a hygiene procedure in the ward in the middle of May of 1847. All the staff in the maternity ward carefully washed their hands. He had them sterilize their instruments by soaking them in a chlorine solution. The mortality rate in April had been over 18%, almost 1 in 5 patients. In June, July, and August, the average mortality rate was below 2%. And then, for the first time in the ward's history, a month went by when no one died of childbed fever at all. All because they washed their hands. I tell you this story because what a triumph! What a moment for all humankind! It needs to be more widely known, but also because of what it says about belief and doubt. In some ways, Semmelweis's breakthrough was the result of his beliefs. He believed in gathering data and testing ideas. He believed that ordinary people, given the right evidence, can figure stuff out about how the world works and that they can solve problems. But in other ways, Semmelweis's breakthrough happened in spite of his beliefs. He didn't believe in germ theory because in 1847, it didn't really exist. Instead, Semmelweis had to overcome, or at least ignore, the prevailing stories of the causes of disease at the time. Namely, that disease was caused by an imbalance of different fluids in the body or exposure to poisons in the air. He also had to let go of beliefs about the superiority of his medical profession over the traditional practices of midwives, and about childbed fever being a different disease from the one that affected a man whose cut was exposed to a corpse. For this one insight, Semmelweis had to change his mind about all kinds of things. But this story is also notable for the minds that didn't change. Many of Semmelweis's colleagues were not so flexible. Despite dramatic results and the evangelical testimony of his students, Semmelweis's recommendations were vehemently rejected by Europe's medical community. And Semmelweis himself was treated like a crackpot. His book on the subject was witheringly criticized. What exactly, his colleagues wanted to know, was being transferred from the morgue to the birthing room? How could something in such trace quantities cause such system-wide illness? Not even the world's most potent toxins could do that. Perhaps the sting of admitting that it was the hands of doctors themselves that caused the deaths of these women was too great. So instead of hand washing, most doctors continued to practice as usual, and then treat the mothers who contracted childbed fever with enemas and bloodletting. For his part, Semmelweis became increasingly indignant and hostile. As far as he was concerned, his fellow physicians were responsible for thousands of preventable deaths. He pulled no punches telling them so. In 1865, he had a kind of breakdown, the exact nature of which isn't clear. His family prevailed upon a doctor to take him to an asylum, under the pretense of observing its medical practice, but with the true intention of having him admitted as a patient. When Semmelweis discovered the ruse, he resisted. The guards beat him and restrained him in a straitjacket. And in the fight, Semmelweis injured his hand. The wound got infected, and 2 weeks later he died. The doctors attributed his death to blood poisoning. Today we would recognize it as a systemic bacterial infection. Basically, the same disease that Semmelweis had spent his life trying to prevent. With the benefits of hindsight, it's easy to paint the doctors of the medical establishment who ridiculed Semmelweis's ideas as stubborn boors, lashing out at anything they didn't understand, and that's probably true for some of them. But I'd bet that other doctors honestly believed that they were doing the right thing in an age plagued even more by predatory and pseudoscientific medical woo than our own. Scalding your instruments in chlorine, a known poison, could have easily seemed like the work of a 19th century Dr. Oz, something that needed to be refuted to protect an overly credulous public. Changing your mind is hard because you are often the person least likely to recognize that it needs to be changed. But that's not the end of the story. Some doctors did espouse Semmelweis's hygiene protocols. In the next few decades, the work of Louis Pasteur and Joseph Lister helped to cement a new theory of germs that explained why Semmelweis's protocols worked. Vaccinations prevented terrible diseases. Pasteurization made foods safer and last longer. Joseph Lister reintroduced the idea of antiseptic protocols during surgery, and sterilizing implements became widespread. Little by little, new approaches made medicine safer. Doctors would change out their street clothes into scrubs. Tools would be autoclaved. Sterile dressings were invented and used around wounds. Face masks were used. The number of people in the operating theater was reduced. And of course, doctors washed and scrubbed their hands. It would be years before hand washing by surgeons and doctors became commonplace. It would be a century before it became public practice. But it did. In that century, it wasn't just doctors who changed their minds. It was humanity. Today, hand washing is still public health's greatest tool. It saves millions of lives every year. And in 2022, for the first time in the history of the world, 3/4 of the world's population had access to basic hygiene. It is hard to be aware of and thankful for deaths that don't happen. It is hard to see all of the kids who haven't lost parents or the families that haven't been devastated by the loss of a child. But there are so many, maybe even you. There's no way for us to know. These uncounted millions live because people changed their minds. There are countless stories like this, but I chose this one because it is so iconic, both for the beliefs that were changed and for the beliefs that weren't. Today, some even call the tendency to reject evidence that contradicts current beliefs the Semmelweis reflex, as if it were an unconscious, uncontrollable reaction. And there is clearly something unconscious about it. Sometimes we clearly know that there might be evidence to contradict our beliefs, and we still turn away. Someone once told me not to tell them about the labor practices of a clothes manufacturer because she didn't want to feel guilty about it. And another friend once said about a political conversation, "Let's not talk about this. I don't want to change my mind." Or the religiously minded person who is afraid of ideas that might undermine their faith. But I don't think this kind of willful ignorance is typical. Teachers, people whose job it is to literally change minds, see this every day. In the mid-1980s, the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics produced a 20-minute documentary video called A Private Universe about this very thing. It opened with a series of interviews with recent Harvard graduates still in their caps and gowns. The interviewers asked them to explain what caused seasons and the phases of the moon, things regularly taught in middle school. It's pretty painful for this science teacher to listen to Harvard graduates blaze confidently through explanations based on common misconceptions. In the second half of the video, the researchers interview 9th graders who have just learned about these same concepts, but even those who had exemplary scores on their tests fell back on their naive and sometimes convoluted ideas when they were asked to explain in more detail. We don't usually fail to change our minds because we're stubborn. We fail because it's hard to do. Maybe clinging to our old ideas actually is a reflex. The costs of this reflex aren't always so high as in the case of medical hygiene, but our inability to change our minds causes us to miss opportunities and persist in damaging habits and repeat mistakes and fail to adapt. In his book, Think Again, Adam Grant tells the story of how the creator of the BlackBerry smartphone just could not get over the idea of having a keyboard on his smartphone instead of a touchscreen, and watched his company's share of the market drop from 50% to less than 1% in just 5 years. People ignore evacuation warnings during hurricanes despite the best efforts of officials. In every major storm, you can find them telling news anchors that sticking it out last time wasn't so bad. True believers stick with the doomsday cult even after the world doesn't end. They just wait for their prophets to revise the date of the rapture. I don't know why it's so hard for people to change their ideas, but the Semmelweis reflex affects all of us. We rationalize, we get defensive, we ignore or undersell the ideas that contradict what we want or what we expect. It is so easy to get stuck in beliefs that aren't serving us. It's kind of a miracle that we end up changing our minds at all. I get stuck in the Semmelweis reflex all the time. Well into my first year as a science teacher, I carried around deep-seated misunderstandings of Newton's laws of motion, and I still feel the sting of embarrassment when I remember the mitigation I had to do after one particularly botched lesson. And then there are these awful memories of Laura's senior prom when I just could not let go of my ideas about what constituted danceable music and consigned my date to spending most of the evening sitting at a table instead of on the dance floor. I spent years chastising myself for cowardice and lack of conviction because I hadn't followed through on my youthful dreams of living in the wilderness. Suffice it to say that I don't have the secret to flexible thinking. I am grateful for people like Ignaz Semmelweis or Charles Darwin or Rosa Parks who serve as heroes of doubt and who have precipitated the changing of all of our minds. But I also want to express my thanks for the wise teachers who have shown me strategies for freeing myself from beliefs that have outlived their utility. Many of them were scientists. I mean, that makes sense. Science is, after all, systematic about dismantling ideas that don't match the evidence. And in a large part, this episode is a thank you both to the science I have learned and the people who have helped me to learn to use it. There was the forest ecologist that I worked with in graduate school named Mark Lappin. I remember one assignment in a field trip in the woods when he asked us to look around and describe what we observed. And people said things like, "It looks like there's a history of fire at this site." And the professor would say, "That's not an observation." So someone else would say, "Based on the species here, I'd say that the soil here is pretty rich." And he would say the same thing, "Not an observation." And after a couple more contributions like this, Mark shook his head and said, "It's really hard to separate observation from interpretation, but you've got to if you're going to think scientifically. There's a stone wall. That's an observation. There's some red maples here. That's an observation. Observation is just what you see, just what you sense, without extrapolation from you. That's what evidence is." Mark taught me that before I could question an idea, I had to recognize that I was having one. I had to see the interpretations I was making for what they were. Then there was Carl Sagan, whose book Science as a Candle in the Dark was the first systematic and comprehensible explanation I'd encountered for how science worked and what made it so powerful. Contrary to what I thought, science wasn't there to prove things. It was there to disprove. Carl taught me how science is brutal with ideas. It is a doubt machine. It doubts everything, systematically and on purpose. He says, "It's not perfect. It can be misused. It is only a tool. But it is by far the best tool we have. Self-correcting, ongoing, applicable to everything." He says it has two rules. First, there are no sacred truths. All assumptions must be critically examined. Arguments from authority are worthless. And second, whatever is inconsistent with the facts must be discarded and revised. We must understand the cosmos as it is and not confuse how it is with how we wish it to be. The obvious is sometimes false, and the unexpected is sometimes true. The scientific ideas I learned in school weren't proven. They were just the last ideas standing after years and sometimes centuries of abuse by some of the world's cleverest minds. That was why biologists rolled their eyes when people said things like, "Well, after all, evolution is just a theory." To earn the title of theory, the idea of natural selection has to be consistent with every observation of every biologist for the past 160 years. Carl taught me that because I couldn't see my own stuckness, to seek out other people who could, to listen to people on the other side and see what I could learn from them. He taught me to follow up my reading of any convincing book or blog post or video with another expressing a different view. But maybe the most potent counsel I ever received came from innovative science teachers working to better help students understand the nature of science. I'm especially indebted to Roger Tobin, a physicist from Tufts, who helped me to understand how scientific ideas emerge only in the interplay between storytelling and skepticism, between belief and doubt, and that I needed to let my students wrestle with both. How does a scientific model come about? We come up with stories. We see what they can explain. And when they don't work, we change them or add to them. Or in some cases, we scrap them altogether. Our stories, our models, our beliefs can evolve. And when I look at it like that, I think a lot less about the rightness or wrongness of my beliefs. Wrongness isn't really a problem. All my beliefs are wrong. They'll all break down at some point because I am telling simple stories to make sense of a complicated world. But in another sense, none of them are wrong because they're all just works in progress. Like the poet Rumi says, out beyond right doing and wrong doing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. And in a third sense, rightness and wrongness aren't even the point. We come up with scientific models for the same reason that we come up with all our beliefs, because they are useful. No scientist nowadays seriously believes that the stars are attached to a rotating celestial sphere. But we still talk about stars like that because it is really useful for finding your way around the night sky. Modern chemists don't think that electrons orbit an atomic nucleus like planets, but students in high school spend most of their chemistry class thinking about electrons this way because you can use that idea to predict which substances will react and how. Einstein showed that Newton's ideas of gravity break down, but we still teach Newton's laws because they work most of the time. All of these lessons have let me be more playful and open and curious, and I think somewhat better at changing my mind. It took a long time and lots of practice for me to really internalize these lessons, and looking back now, I see how I only acquired them because dozens of teachers invested their time and care over decades of my life to help me get there. They are part of a global movement where all over the world, people like them champion free discourse and compassionate listening in a world of ideologies. The traditions of critical thinking and science only exist because people pass it on from generation to generation in the hopes that people of the future will continue to revise and change our cherished ideas and get ever closer to a truth that we will probably never reach. So where does all this leave us? I think it will always be hard for doubt to get the appreciation it is due. It is not sexy. It does not inspire. People will probably always want leaders who exude confidence, leaders who hold on to their beliefs with integrity. But doubt has an integrity of its own. There's a story, perhaps apocryphal, of Gandhi's lieutenants coming to him outraged because Gandhi had canceled a march of protest against the British because he feared the protest would erupt into violence. And his fellow leaders demanded an explanation. People have left their work and traveled great distances to be here. You can't stop now. And Gandhi responded, "I am only human. My understanding changes day to day. My commitment is to truth and not consistency." In my past, I used to think of doubt and faith as opposites, in the same way that I imagined that courage was the opposite of fear. But not anymore. Courage isn't the absence of fear. It is the willingness to do what is necessary despite fear. And faith, I now think, is the same. The world will always be uncertain. We will never know for sure whether the playdate will happen. But we can continue to act even as our beliefs unravel, even as our minds change. I can choose to step forward for love and justice, even though my understanding of those things will never quite be perfect. When my oldest daughter was born, I decided to write her a book, a novel. Partly it seemed like a way to pass on what I had learned about the world and to share my vision of what life could be like. My protagonist, Hope, was a 14-year-old girl who basically lived out my own fantasy of what I'd wished my own life had been. Her parents raised her in the woods and trained her to survive, to fend for herself, to be uncompromisingly free. Hope could track the coyotes across bare rock and disappear into the shadows. She could tell by listening to the birds where the deer were. She was everything I wanted to be. And I think I created her in an attempt to show my own daughter how beautiful my vision of living wild was. I wanted to show her that civilization was flawed, but that humans could choose to live with integrity and independence by eschewing it. In my story, Hope was sent to live in suburban Connecticut against her wishes and forced to reckon with the society that I saw as so flawed. And then something surprising happened, something surprising even to me as I was writing it. As I had introduced characters who had become Hope's friends, I think I had expected them to become Hope's disciples, people who would follow her away from civilization to live wild and free. But instead, these new characters, seemingly without my permission, began to give voice to all kinds of reasons to stay in the civilized world. It was only after months of writing that I realized that those reasons were mine. They were my own. And I began to see that Hope herself was torn between living free and alone, or living in society bound to the people that she loved. And then I realized that the book wasn't for Eva. It was for me. This was the choice that I'd had to make when I started my family. And I had chosen civilization. And I had chosen people over principles. I'd chosen Laura and our children. All this time, I'd been angry with myself for my failures to stick to my convictions and for my lack of perseverance. But all I'd done was chosen love, and that wasn't a bad choice. My doubt wasn't a failing. It was a virtue. As Richard Feynman put it, in order to make progress, one must leave the door to the unknown ajar. And that is a much more interesting way to live. To me, that sounds like doubt and faith all at once. I Heart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian Imaro Cribbs. Our theme song is used with permission from neosounds.com. New episodes are released sometime around the 14th of every month. You can find our complete archive with transcripts of each show on our website, iheartthispodcast.com. If you follow us on Facebook at iHeartThisPodcast, you can get monthly announcements of our episode releases so you don't have to miss any, and get occasional musings about things to be grateful for. I'd love to know what your thoughts are about this episode, so send them to me at ben@iheartthispodcast.com. And the only marketing that happens for iHeartThis is the recommendations that you make on its behalf. So if you enjoyed this episode, please consider telling your friends or leaving a review. Thank you so, so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.